Coming to you from Vancouver, British Columbia, it's From the Backline, the podcast dedicated to the Whitecaps, MLS, and all things soccer. Here are your hosts, Mark Daly and Jorge Mendoza.
Welcome to episode 26 of From the Backline, the official podcast of 86forever.com. I'm your host, Mark Daly, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host. Insert co-host name here. What? Insert co-host? What's going on here? Like, I asked you to do the show notes this week. You forgot to put your own name in. Maddie. Anyways, as always, I'm joined by my co-host and friend, Jorge, insert co-host name here, Mendoza. How are you doing this evening?
You should know better than trusting me with the notes.
With the important things?
Yeah, no.
Man, the show went sideways really early this week. Screw all that stuff. Let's just fly off the
seat of our pants.
We'll just go for it this week. So how are you doing? How was your long weekend?
It was great. Yeah, it was. I went up to Whistler. Obviously, you know, I lived in Whistler for 6 years, so it was nice to go back up, and I caught up with a few friends and things like that, and it was a little rainy, but it doesn't really matter. You know, there's something really appealing about life in Whistler. The air is so fresh, everything is so close.
And it's been Saturday night for the past 25 years?
Yeah, that's also helps. You know, my commute used to be literally 7 minutes. 7 minutes. I was at work. Yeah, it was good times. You know, obviously, you know, being in the city also has its advantages. I can play soccer, you know, year round. I get to do the show. You know, it's easier to get to the Whitecaps games and things like that. But
speaking of which, I hear that a certain From the Backline co-host has now been named captain of Astro FC.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thanks, man. Yeah. We just got a new coach. For the summer season, he's from Spain. You know, he went to a couple games, and he asked me if I wanted to be the captain. And yeah, you know,
as long as you're not going to try and parlay that into your bizarre parallels of your life and our team captain Jay Demerit,
dude, that's just another thing. Like, you know, have I mentioned on air all the things that I have in common with Jay Demerit?
Oh heavens, please spare our friends and listeners.
It's really intense, man. Like, here it goes. It's okay, real quick.
The only comparison I can see between you and Jay Demerit is you both are married to lovely women who are gold medalists. And by that, I mean that his lovely wife, Ashley McIver, won a gold medal at the 2010 Olympic Games here in Vancouver. And your lovely wife deserves a gold medal because she has to put up with you each and every day of the week.
No, you know, I was talking about this the other day with one of my coworkers, and he was actually blown away by all the things that I have in common with Jay Demerit. Here he goes. We're both foreigners in this Canadian land. We're both central backs. We're both obviously captain on our teams now. We have both played at Azteca Stadium. We both married last year. We both married in Whistler. Both of our wives went to, they are from Whistler. Both of our wives went to the same high school. They went to the same high school at the same time. So that's just 10 right there. And obviously the most important one is that, we're both, tall, handsome, blonde, and athletic.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Maybe that one is a little bit of a stretch. I'm not blonde.
You're stretching a lot of things there, especially the blonde hair thing. You know, that's about the only thing I have in common with Jay, and I have his name and number on the back of my shirt. But hey, that leads me to the next thing. I believe our friend Aaron Campbell sent us an email regarding shirts and numbers on them.
He did. Fellow podcaster and blogger Aaron Campbell from AFTN Canada sent us a bunch of questions after we asked you guys to send us anything that we wanted to discuss. Aaron's questions, which, you know, he has a bum leg, and I hope that he's getting better because obviously he's just sitting at home without doing anything and he needs a hobby. But anyway, so he sent us a bunch of questions. One of them was, what do you think of people who get their own name put on the back of pro soccer team jerseys? Well, Aaron, I'm happy that you asked. I think it's a complete acceptable practice. And this is the rationale behind that. Number one, you know, players come and go. They, you know, a player that might be here today, who knows where he's going to be tomorrow. But we as supporters, we are going to be here, you know, day in and day out for years to come. If I'm going to be here, you know, why not put my name on the jersey? Right. And not only that, you know, aren't we part of the team don't they, you know, keep saying over and over again that, you know what, you know, we do our part and we, you know, we're thank to us, but, you know, we play a huge part in the success of the team. Well, I think that we deserve a little bit of credit, you know, with our name in the back. And also, you know, you see all those poor people with like the Camilo jerseys. Don't you feel bad for them? You know, I'm not going to go away anywhere.
Well, anyway, that's my stand on it. You actually posing in a Mexican team kit would actually be quite acceptable. Unless exactly. It was one other than America Eagles.
Hey,
if it was like Chivas Guadalajara or Toluca or something like that, then you know, maybe some of your friends back home might take exception to that. But that answer was spoken by somebody that probably has Mendoza 3 on the back of his Whitecaps shirt.
I might have one or two.
There you go. And I believe Aaron also had another question more specifically aimed at you personally.
He did. Let me see real quick. Why is Jorge so unsociable before a game and won't come a drink with me? Well, Aaron, I'm also glad that you asked that. You know, I am a man who is busy. You know, I'm busy. I would love to come and have a drink with you, Aaron. And I'm sure that we'll make it happen. I'll get my people to get in touch with your people and we'll schedule something. And it's going to be grand.
Well, I think we're just going to have to strong arm you and drag you in because you didn't actually answer his question. But it's all good. Anyways, we've been joking around here as we usually do. But before we get into the topics for this week, we have to mention something really serious here. We would like to extend our deepest condolences to John Sakaris, who runs 86forever.com, because his father, James, suddenly passed away last Thursday at the very young age of 56. So on behalf of myself and Jorge and our families, we would like to extend our condolences to John and his family. They're obviously in our thoughts and our prayers for the untimely passing of his dad. So it's quite sad news that we heard just over the weekend.
Just it's hard to say anything on this time, but except for that, you know, we're sorry and, you know, whatever we can do to help, we'll be more than happy to do so.
Yeah, exactly. So, like I say, hope John's doing good and hope that they're managing in this very difficult time. So moving right along, I wanted to talk a little bit more. I'm sorry, but it's the topics aren't going to get any cheerier anytime soon this week. But I wanted to go back and talk a little bit more about the Hillsborough disaster that we talked about last week. And as we mentioned last week, it was the 25th anniversary of the disaster that happened in 1989. And after we recorded last week, the ESPN 30 for 30 special came out and it focused on the entire disaster from the day that it happened right up to basically what's unfolding today. It really just blew my mind. Like I didn't see it because it hasn't aired up here, but I did manage to see it online. And I told you before we started recording, I was literally intended to sit down for about 5 or 10 minutes because it's about an hour and 45 minutes long. I thought I would sit down Thursday night, maybe watch 5 or 10 minutes and then just watch the rest over the weekend as time allowed. And it literally hooked me right off of the bat.
It's compelling.
It's very compelling. It's not for the faint-hearted because it's a very disturbing story, obviously. And honestly, it is the first time that I've seen any of the footage since I remember the disaster happening. I was in my early teens when it happened back in 89. And I remember seeing all the horrible pictures of, you know, the people trapped inside of on the terraces that couldn't get out. But it just, it really just grabbed my attention right away. And it's very sobering because it doesn't even start. The documentary doesn't even start what happened that afternoon. It actually starts in the weeks and months before the two teams, Nottingham Forest and Liverpool, were drawn together in the FA Cup semi-final. Now, what had happened, precinct that was responsible for Hillsborough Stadium, there was a bit of a hazing scandal that involved some more experienced police constables and a newer recruit where basically I think they phoned in a false alarm or something. This young policeman went off and he was sort of quote unquote held up at gunpoint and then handcuffed. It was basically like a hazing thing. So there was a fallout and there was an inquiry and there was people were suspended and fired. And the chief and superintendent that was in charge of the precinct responsible for Hillsborough, he was transferred just weeks before the match between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest.
Yeah, and welcome to the new gig.
Well, yeah, exactly. So what happened was he was transferred off to another post somewhere else, and he was replaced by this Chief Superintendent Duckenfield, who was in charge. He was actually in the police box at Hillsborough on the day that it happened. Now, not only, I mean, he was obviously as a chief superintendent, he was quite experienced as a police officer. But the big difference between him and his predecessor was that he didn't have the experience. He didn't have the knowledge. He didn't understand football, and he didn't understand what it took to police a football match, especially one of that magnitude. And as we mentioned last week, what had happened was there was a large number of Liverpool supporters that were delayed in actually arriving to the ground. And if you see like the CCTV footage of the day, like I believe it's called the Leaping Lane area behind the stadium, there's a very like confined forecourt. And people said that even in the minutes leading up to the kickoff, they were walking up the street to the stadium among the terraced houses and things like that, and they couldn't believe how quiet it was. And so what happened is there was a big, you know, rush of people towards the end, and they were actually afraid with this rather confined area that there was going to be some, you know, emergency, some problem out front that people might get hurt. So what happened was, you know, they had these very sort of narrow turnstiles, and people were getting, you know, they just weren't getting through in the numbers that they expected, because there were other Liverpool supporters that had been there to matches before, and other people, and they'd never experienced anything like that. They didn't even know that there was like such a vast amount of people attending the match, because there was no line up to get in. So anyways, what happened was that the police opened up this gate on the side, and all these people started to flow into the, you know, the pens, these segregated pens on the terraces. And when you see the pictures, it just blew me away, because they said that part of the reason that they chose Hillsborough for the for that match specifically was the geographic location. It was fairly convenient for both people coming from Merseyside and from the Midlands, up from Nottingham to, you know, it was easier for both of them, to both sets of fans, and say going down to Wembley in London. Anyways, also the other thing that attractive to play the match at Hillsborough was, in those days, even though it wasn't all seater, like with the standing room and the seated parts of the stadium, was about a 54,000 capacity in the ground itself. So obviously for a big match, like a cup semifinal, that's really attractive. Anyways, when you see the pictures, especially the end, like the side of the stadium where the Liverpool fans are, it is just absolutely mind-blowing, the sea of humanity. But when you see those pens behind the goal, it is just, it is dense. You can just tell. And then as, you know, they show the things like happening, that you can tell that something's going very long. And honestly, I don't remember how much of the match they played. I think it was only a couple of minutes before they had to stop it, and it just went horribly wrong. But the thing that I found, obviously, the scenes of the disaster itself are very disturbing, but what is equally disturbing is how certain elements of the powers that be tried to cover up or manipulate what happened almost like right from the very moment that it had happened. The coroner that was involved, he wanted to make sure that they drew people's blood level, alcohol levels, and they published those all in the newspapers, along with like criminal records. And, you know, regardless of the age, you know, we mentioned that the youngest victim, whose name was John Paul Gilhooley, is actually Stephen Gerrard's cousin. And Stephen Gerrard, for those of you know who are fans of Liverpool, is obviously the team captain. So they just right from the very beginning, there was a lot of disrespect to the families. The families came up, they were made to wait across the street in this horrible old boys' club, and they were brought in. Basically, there was all these Polaroids of the victims on the wall, and then in no order, and then they were pulled out, but to identify. And there was just the cover up, people's statements were altered. It's just, absolutely shocking. But there was a couple of, we mentioned last week the Taylor report, and how that basically noted that there was problems with how the event was policed, and, you know, laid a lot of the blame with the South Yorkshire police. But apart from the changes to the stadia, that didn't really float. So about, I think it was the late 90s when the Labour government, when Tony Blair's Labour government came into power, they revisited the whole thing, and nothing really came of it. It wasn't until 2012, when the Hillsborough Independent Panel, which was headed by the Bishop of Liverpool, they reviewed everything, and they found thousands of documents. And the most disturbing thing that they found, in addition, obviously, to the manipulation of evidence, is that because of the poor coordination and response of the emergency services on that day, that over 40 people could have been saved that actually died on that day. Just absolutely disturbing. And that, and the fact that they found a lot of the original statements given by police officers, just, you know, regular police constables that were there as part of the crowd control, who had noted in their statements, had noted, you know, the shortcomings and the problems and things like that, and how they were amended and edited. And then, basically altered to take out anything negative regarding the police actions those days. So, and also, like I mentioned, they publish people's criminal records. And I mean, they just basically try to paint people, you know, damage their reputation for people that couldn't speak for themselves. Because I mean, they were obviously victims of the disaster, and they, you know, they were dead. I found that despicable. I found that absolutely dreadful. But the good thing is that eventually, just in the last couple of years, what with the Hillsborough Independent panel, all this is coming to light. And there's actually a new inquest that's only just started a couple of weeks ago. So, like I say, I hate to really kind of like bring up such a like a sad and very, you know, tragic event, but it is really it's something that I think that everybody should at least take the time to look at, because it, as we talked about before, I mean, you shouldn't go to a football match and you should go to be able to enjoy yourself and not have something like that. And just the way that people's reputations and names are dragged for the gutter for a quarter century and what their families had to endure just to get answers is just absolutely, it's incomprehensible to me. I just can't go get over it. But like I say, it aired last week on ESPN down in the States. It'll air up here sometime on TSN. So keep an eye open on it. But just a little bit of extra sort of like, you know, backstory to this. Hillsborough Stadium was actually built in 1899. And it's been the home to Sheffield Wednesday FC ever since. Outside of the Premiership, it is the largest ground in England. Like even today, there's still about a 39,000 seat capacity. Like, I mean, you look at the pictures, like all the stock footage they have from the late 90s, and they talk about how the stadium was rebuilt or renovated in the mid 60s for the 1966 World Cup. I was looking at some of these pictures of the ground as it was in the time of when the disaster happened. I'm just like, oh, come on, man. This place looks horrible. It looks like the mortar's falling apart and the bricks are going to start falling apart. But they've been talking about also, because in addition to the 66 World Cup, they hosted matches there in the mid 90s for the European Championships in 1996. So they haven't really had any upgrades to it. And they've been talking about even, I think it was in the last 3 or 4 years, they'd approved a plan to upgrade it, bring it up to FIFA standards. So if the English FA wants to try and host the World Cup or the Euros again or whatever, that they have to do that. But even though they have a plan in place, as of last year, nothing has happened, and it's kind of just in limbo right now. But there's, like I say, it's a really tragic story, and one to check out for sure, because I mean, a lot of the people that died that day were just normal people like all of us that go to enjoy the game of football. And like I say, I don't think nobody should have to meet with such a horrible end.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's and hopefully, like you said, I think the biggest part is this, that all these people get some justice and maybe a little bit of closure for their families.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, 25 years has been long enough. Anyways, we'll move on for that. So why don't we take a little bit of an early break this evening? And when we come back, we'll talk about happier topics, including the Whitecaps 2-2 draw against the LA Galaxy. You're listening to From the Backline. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to From the Backline, the official podcast of 86forever.com. We're pleased once again to welcome back our very first sponsor. We introduced him last week. And if you didn't listen to last week's episode, we had our very first sponsor, and it's a website. So just head over to www.havethetimbersonamatchyet.com. And Mark, why don't you just do the honors this week and see what the answer of that is?
Well, okay. Well, let's just take a look. And the answer is, has Portland won a match yet? And the answer is no, they still have not won a match yet in 2014.
Yeah, well, Portland lost last weekend 1-0 to Real Salt Lake at Rio Tinto Stadium down in Sandy, Utah, where the Whitecaps will be playing this this coming weekend. However, this means that the Timbers' record is now 0 wins, 3 losses, and 4 draws for 4 points, which keeps them just a single point against the hapless San Jose Earthquakes, who are also winless in 2014.
Yeah, you know what I think is a little bit interesting about this? You take a look at Portland, obviously winless in 2014. Take a look at Montreal, who are winless in 2014. And obviously, those are two clubs that are, you know, rivals, our rivals, not only in MLS, but going back to the pre-MLS days. And I kind of look back, I sort of rewind to this time last year and how we kind of look at how though the Whitecaps struggled at times and how people kind of look a little bit to the Timbers and the Impact as our expansion cousins, if you will, and you know how they were doing. Because, I mean, through 7 matches in 2013, the Whitecaps were 2-3-2. Portland were about the same. They were 2-1-4. But Montreal were 5-1-1. And you look at them now, like neither of them have won a match, and Montreal has just completely lost their way. And I just kind of wonder now if, how long Frank Lopez will last in Montreal after he took over the end of last year after Marco Schallebaum left. And I just don't think.
Dreadful.
Yeah, I just don't think that the Saputo, like Joey Saputo, is really a patient kind of guy. So I kind of wonder how long he'll be the head man at Stade Saputo over there, because they are just Montreal is actually dead last in the running for the Supporters Shield, and they're just they've sort of turned into new Chivas.
Yes, yeah,
I mean, because Chivas, of course, last year was just an absolute joke. So they are just completely lost their way, and they looked pretty good at times last year.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, obviously Marco Di Vaio was a big part of that. Yeah, we'll see. That, you know, that helps, helps us, the Whitecaps, obviously not necessarily that much on MLS, but at least on the Canadian Championship, you know, that they're going to be facing us, Toronto, which would, you know, they might have a chance with Toronto not, having some woes in terms of injuries, but at this rate, it doesn't look like they're going to be much of a challenge for Toronto. But, well, thanks for our sponsor, havethetimberswonamatch.com, once again, and it will be continued to be funny, until they win a match, in which case we'll
it won't
drop
be
them.
Funny anymore, but.
Yeah. So, let's, just, look back, Mark, real quick at last weekend's 2-2 draw, against the Galaxy. Based on what happened on the pitch, can't really say that it was the worst scenario for Vancouver. I texted you right after the game and said I don't know how I feel about this this result. Obviously, it's better than a loss, but once again, the Whitecaps were unable to get full points at home, which is worrying. It's just the second home game in a row. They haven't won in the last 3. And they have 1 out of 9 points. So there were some positives, but also definitely things that are concerning about.
Well, I totally agree, because when you texted me right after the game, I completely thought the same thing too. Like, and I think my response was that, you know, I don't know about, I have to go back and watch it again to really kind of feel about it. Like my immediate reaction was there were positives in the match, but at the same time, there are still several, you know, things that are really, you know, red flags essentially that leave me, you know, quite concerned about a couple of things. But I mean, just sort of starting with the match, I thought that the first 10 minutes, you know, to start the match weren't bad. I thought that there were some, you know, there was a couple of positive things at least. The defending was okay to start the match. There was a couple of forays into the LA half of the pitch that looked promising. But at about, you know, the quarter hour of a mark, I thought that the Whitecaps were looking a little scrappy, especially the service to Maddox and Miller wasn't there. There was a couple of times where Kofi would make a bit of a surging run. He kind of put through a nice ball, but it wasn't too anywhere where Darren or Kenny could really, you know, take advantage of it.
Yeah, and I felt that, you know, pretty much almost the entire first half, it was really like, I think that the stats are a, you know, I think the Whitecaps actually had more possession in the first half than, but it certainly didn't feel that way on the day. I felt that the Galaxy was really pressing high. There were at times where they were not really giving the ball to Vancouver, and they didn't really have any possession. Obviously, the first half ended 1-0 going to LA after you know, organization in the back that cost him going down in the first half. Yeah, it was not the best 45 minutes that we have seen. However, having said that, I did tweet it in at halftime that maybe that was Steven Bettishaw's best 45 minutes as a whitecap.
Yeah, I thought that on the day he was one of the best, if not the best, whitecap. I watched the match again last night. I was pretty impressed by his play all around, and I thought he defended well. He got forward well. He made several nice crosses. Unfortunately, nobody really got on the end of them. But yeah, I thought it was definitely the best game that he's had since he came to Vancouver in the off season for sure.
You know, it's been a little bit of a steady climb for him. I think that we spoke about him last episode, and I think that he's slowly coming to form and starting to claim really the tag that came with him, that after Robbo said that he was arguably the best right back in the league, and I think that he's sort of starting to show that, and it's just I guess that's one of the positives that came out of that match, the play by Steven Bettishaw. He's starting to come forward a little bit more. It'll be interesting to see how he does in the next few games, and hopefully he continues this, as I said, this steady climb to a better form.
Well, he was 2 for 5 in his crosses. He was 1 for 3 in tackles, 3 for 3 in clearances, and he was 37 for 45 in his passes. But I mean, he looked like a presence out there at the right back position.
His positioning was really, really good.
Yeah, because like in the first couple of matches or so far this season that I've seen him, I've kind of been. He just didn't look completely integrated into the squad, or he didn't look 100% comfortable. So I think what we saw on Saturday is how he's continuing to grow into his role in the team and get more familiar with those he's playing with, get familiar with the style of play that Vancouver has. So that was really positive. Well, what I also thought, just sort of going back to some of the chances that Vancouver had in the first half, I know it wasn't all rosy as we've just been talking about, but the best chance for the Whitecaps, I thought, came at about the just after the 20-minute mark when Morales made a really cheeky little chip forward and got it over the heads of the LA back line. Miller ran onto the ball, crossed it into the box for Maddox, and he was just right at the edge of the 6-yard box, but he just couldn't get his head on the ball. And that was Vancouver's best opportunity of the half. I thought that the play, I didn't think that one side or the other really dominated each other. But as you said, like LA was really pressuring up high. And I noticed that the link up play wasn't there again. And they would just really pressure the Whitecaps whenever they had the ball. And by the time that the Whitecaps were able to move it forward, LA had already got, plenty of guys behind the ball, and
they kept their shape really well.
Yeah, they did.
And just going back a little bit on that, that chance by Maddox, he tried to do a diving header. And I wonder if he would try to like get it with his foot instead of maybe he would have had a bit of a chance. He was really close to bearing it. But unfortunately, obviously that was not the case. Yeah, like you said. And then in minute 38, that's when the Galaxy scored the first goal. That opened the score sheet.
Well, what really worried me about that is I thought that with the going back to the 4-4-2 diamond was that there isn't really any width to the midfield. And I don't think we maybe have the players that are really good to play out those wider positions in the 4-4-2 diamond. Because if you notice what happened is that the play originated and was cleared out of the Vancouver's third of the field. And Gargan runs onto the ball and he comes down the right channel and he's basically unchallenged. There's nobody there. If you look, Tybert's in the middle of the pitch. Laba is in his usual area of the pitch, just at the base of the diamond. Harvey is just outside of the 18-yard box for Vancouver, which you would expect to see like a left back, but they're all about 10 yards from the ball. And what happens is if you watch the replay, you see Matias Laba draw over from the middle of the pitch where he usually is at the top of the 18-yard box. And he puts a little bit of pressure on Gargan, who floats across into the box towards the back post. It gets headed down by Husidic, and basically it falls to Stefan Ishizaki and Landon Donovan, who are completely unmarked at the penalty spot. And it was pretty easy for Ishizaki because he just put a head to it and put into the back of the net. And Harvey, who was covering the post, managed to get a bit of a leg to it or something, but he wasn't able to keep it out. But what happens is when you see the ball go into the cross go in, Betashur is trying to cover Husidic, who still manages, wins, that headed duel, nods it down. O'Brien draws over towards the back post. He's covering Omar Gonzalez, who was well up on the play. Demerit's in the middle of the box. He isn't really covering anybody. But as the ball goes into the box, Harvey follows Keane and sticks pretty tight with him. So Demerit is the only guy that isn't really marking anyone. As the ball comes back to Ishizaki, if you look at the just outside of the box, are Russell Tybert and Matthias Laban. And they're probably the two closest people to Donovan and Ishizaki, but it was an easy goal, basically. I mean, Ishizaki put his head to it and put it into the back of the net before Vancouver could really react, because they were starting to look a little bit loose at the back there, yeah, leading up to that goal. And it's, very similar to the goal that, that Keane scored the week before. They were playing pretty good, and then all of a sudden they just started to fall apart in the minutes leading up to it, and they got burned.
Obviously, it would be the same story in the second goal. It would be a cross that gets redirected, and then someone will put it away. And as a central back myself, I don't want to sound like I'm making excuses, but well, here we go. Those balls are really difficult to defend, because once the first header comes back in, like when they're heading it back into the box, it's really hard to defend, because then everything gets disorganized and everything. And that, that's no excuse, and someone should have been in there, because once again, a Galaxy player was completely alone inside the box that just put it away. So
it wasn't one, it was two.
Exactly, right? So then, it's something that you can point fingers and see who should have been marking it, but at the end of the day, a goal of this kind is just like a series of mistakes that start to cascading down, right?
So yes, very much so, and especially like because there was. I just don't like how that whole midfield was shaping up. I mean, there was acres of space between the midfield and the Whitecaps back line, and there was several instances, similar occurrences that happened because of that, where the LA attackers would just have that. They'd have a lot of space between the midfield and the Whitecaps back line, and it was on that instance they got burned on it.
Yeah. So they went to halftime with the Whitecaps trailing 1-0, and that's when Robinson made a couple of interesting substitutions. He did a double substitution during halftime, which is something that we don't usually see, and he got Leveron in for O'Brien. It was probably substituted because of the yellow card that he got at 30 seconds in, which I didn't get to see. I saw it just during the day. They didn't show it back on the replay on the stadium, and it wasn't on the highlights. So I'm not sure. Did you see that again?
It was more of a 50-50 ball, I thought. He put his foot in to reach for it. Keane was reaching for it, and he may have touched him on the end of his boot. But Keane went down like a ton of bricks, clutching his boot. And
yeah,
I mean, Petrescu is Petrescu, and there's a reason why he is not very popular amongst the supporters in Vancouver. I mean, especially, I didn't think it was worth a yellow card that early in the match. If he wanted to make his point, I think he could have equally as done as well by just coming across and telling Andy to cool it, because I didn't really think there was any malice in it. I don't think it was reckless. Yeah, I think that was part of the reason that Robinson substituted Andy, because he said, like in the interview at halftime, or when they came out after the half, that he really wanted to go for it. And I think he wanted his players to be a little bit more aggressive. I think that, Andy already being on a yellow, and obviously what we saw with Matthias 2 weeks earlier in the Colorado match, that, he got, burned for it. I mean, obviously the circumstances were a little bit different, but, maybe he was afraid that, Andy might be a little bit, hesitant, maybe not to be as physical or as challenge as much, because Petrescu is a little bit erratic in his judgment at times. So that might have part of the reason why he brought on Leveron for O'Brien, which I thought was good. I thought the two substitutes immediately injected some energy into the side, because I thought that at times they lacked that little bit of a spark. And then a little bit later on, just after the hour mark, he brought Morales off and put Eric Hurtado on. So I kind of wonder how much Pedro's lower back is bothering him. But Hurtado, all credit to him, I thought that he had an impact on the match. You know, obviously not to the same extent as Mane, but he was involved and some promising things from Eric now and again. So it seemed to have worked, the substitutes they had. I mean, unfortunately, sort of getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, LA's second goal was, again, that one was completely preventable. It didn't come too long after Vancouver drawn level, and I thought Darren did very well to score the goal because he got the ball in the box and Pinedo came out to try and cut down the angle, and the very nimble, you know, Darren Maddox managed to get by it, and he still managed to put it in the back of the net, and he was almost at the byline when he did, so that was a very nice piece of skill. But then looking ahead to the second goal, which, you know, that rotten Robbie Keane, which, isn't he just a guy that you love to hate on the LA Galaxy? He's just one player for them that really just gets under my skin. I mean, if he played here, I'm sure we'd all love him, but he just drives me crazy. But again, that was probably a goal that could have been prevented by the Whitecaps. The ball was crossed into the box, and it was a bit of a mismatch, I guess, between Demerit and Rob Friend, because they both went up for the header, and Rob Friend nodded it down, and Robbie Keane pounced on it, and he capitalized, and 2-1.
Yeah, and you know, just touching back a little bit on Petrescu, I hate talking about refs. I hate complaining about him. I think that a team has to win regardless of the ref. But like sometimes with Silvio Petrescu, it's hard, man. Like it's almost as if he wants to appear so impartial when he's refereeing a Canadian team that he goes over the edge and goes almost against them. But anyway, like you mentioned, I think LeBron did really well. He took Tybert out at halftime as well and put Mane in, which I think it was quite unfortunate for Tybert, because as I wrote about it on 86 Forever, like I mentioned, probably the best White Cup the previous week when they played the Galaxy down in California. And so he didn't have a good showing. Mane came in and obviously, like you said, injected a lot of energy. And it's just that will to go forward and bring the game to the other team that certainly help the attack and get LA a little bit in the back foot. And just touching on the goal by Maddox, you know, sometimes you just need to be a little bit lucky, right? And, you know, we were talking about Betashur earlier. It was a lobbing pass forward. Leonardo and Pinedo got a little bit mixed up and, you know, bouncing ball ended up in the feet of Maddox. And kudos to him. He didn't have a lot of angle, and Gonzalez was already closing down. So they didn't have a lot of time and didn't have another angle. However, he managed to put it away, and that was great.
Yeah, he made it count, because we've seen, especially in the first couple of weeks in the season, how close he was getting. He just couldn't. He just wasn't having the luck. He wasn't getting them going in the back of the net. So it's good to see that he's already got two goals this year. He's got three assists, so he's getting very involved in the play. And I really like what I'm seeing from Darren Maddox. He looks like a completely different player compared to last year. So that's good to see. But I mean, he was rewarded, of course. He was the man of the match for Saturday.
Yep.
But just to sort of just speaking in general, though, I didn't think that the Caps looked completely mismatched against the LA Galaxy. In either game, I know we lost last week down at the StubHub Center, but I thought in out of both games, I don't think that they looked
out of place. No, they certainly competed at a high level, and like we mentioned last weekend, it was probably like the loss last weekend was probably a little bit unfair. They could have taken a point down there. I think that this past weekend, it was. A draw was probably a fair result based on what happened on the pitch. And, but more importantly, I think that talking about a little bit more of the positives that we can draw out of this game is that they really didn't, you know, give up, right? They didn't give up. And they, the second goal of LA came at the 76th minute, with a, you know, similar play. And, you know, like you mentioned, Robbie Keane, put it away, and he did. You know, I know how much you love that little cartwheel, and you know his little, you know,
cartwheels and pistols.
You know, so I thought about you when I saw that. Anyone, even myself, I thought it was over. I was like, okay, well, that's it. You know, there's 14 minutes. There's no way they're going to score again. However, they kept at it. Wonderful strike by Mane and put it away with 4 minutes to go. And they were able to get the draw and the point at home, which, you know, when you said, hey, they just barely took a draw at home, doesn't sound awesome. But, you know, based on what happened and the team that they were playing, he's not all that awful. But more importantly, after the goal, they kept going at it and they, you know, they really tried to get the win, right? And I also spoke about this on my article on 86 Forever. David Ostad really, A, kept them in the game, and B, it saved the day after Vancouver already tied it at 2, because Keane had another opportunity right at the, I think it was like the 90th minute. Ostad did a really good save. And then Rob Friend actually had another header in the 93rd minute, and Ostad was able to save that as well. So, as I said, maybe a fair result, and based on what happened on the pitch, you know, a hard fought and, you know, hard earned point.
What do you think, though? There was demerit drew some quite a lot of criticism from some of the fans on Saturday for his role and the goals that were conceded. Since you and Jay apparently are, you know, been separated at birth, maybe we can get your insights into what do you make of that, first of all?
You know, and I also text you after the game about this because I started seeing that on social media, and people were not entirely happy of Jay's display on the day. I thought he was fine. Maybe wasn't his best game, but I didn't think that he was as awful as people arguing that he was.
Well, here, just to back things up, his statistics for the game. He was 8 for 8 on clearances, 0 for 3 on tackles, no fouls, 40 for 48 in completed passes, 6 interceptions. But I guess, especially with the second goal that, you know, Robbie Keane's one that we talked about 15 minutes from full time, he was 4 for 9 in headed duels. And of course, we saw in that one that he, you know, Rob Friend bettered him in the air on that time. And that's what led up to the goal. So I kind of wonder if that's maybe where most of that criticism comes from, because I watched the game again last night and I saw quite a lot, but I thought that in general he looked pretty good, but there were a couple of instances where he could have done better. But I don't, maybe it's just that we expect so much from Jay that even if he has a couple of bad, you know, lapses here or there, that just because Jay's Jay, that people are going to criticize him for any shortcomings out there.
Yeah, and the other, I think that the other thing that with in terms of criticizing Jay is that he relies too much on the sliding tackles, and that's sort of like a reflection of maybe he's not in the right position, and that's the last resource or the last resort that he has to go to, or maybe he's not as quick, and he, you know, that's kind of like what he has to do to recover. But at the end, he's pretty good on, you know, going down. As I said, obviously it's no secret that I'm a fan of Jay's, but and I have a soft spot for central backs, but at the same time, I think maybe it's a little unwarranted, but maybe I'm a little biased on that. So
I still see I see both sides of the argument. I don't think it is as bad as it was made out to be, but, you know, just sort of looking here at the statistics from, the standings afterwards. I mean, Vancouver still isn't all that bad a shape, despite drawing last weekend and losing the week before. We're still in fifth in the Western Conference with 9 points. We're 1 point ahead of LA. You know, it isn't all that bad. I mean, the other thing is that we are in a pretty tough spot in the schedule. We still have that game against Real Salt Lake coming up this weekend. But I mean, after that, you know, going into the month of May, we have the San Jose Earthquakes, play Columbus, which could be a bit of a hard one, because Columbus has had a pretty good start to the season as well this year. And Columbus, actually, they're second in the Eastern Conference right now. They're with 11 points. They've won with their 3-1-2, so they've started pretty good. And then, of course, we've got the ACC matches in May, and then May 24th is when we have our first Cascadia match up here in Vancouver against Seattle. So it is a pretty tough way to start the year, but you know, as you know, Robinson, he said himself after the match that he thought that that what we've seen the last 2 weeks against the Galaxy, that the Whitecaps don't look out of place playing against you know a top side like you know Los Angeles, and I think that's a fair comment.
Yeah, and so and you know, you're now that you're touching on the schedule and the things to come, and maybe looking ahead a little bit on Salt Lake this Saturday, I guess that the question that is being beat to dead, so we have to go there. Would you start Kakuta Mane?
Personally, I think he's still more effective off the bench. I mean, we've seen just how he can change like the outcome of a game, even though, I mean, he got the one goal, obviously, but he just looks dangerous every time he's out there. But I think he's still at that, you know, that sort of spot in his development that maybe to expect a full 90 from him might be a little bit too much, but he's definitely very effective coming on as a substitute.
Yeah, and yeah, I'm going to have to agree with you on this. And I'm basing this just looking back and the games that Kakuta Mane has started. Can you name one of them that has the same impact, that performance at the same level that when he comes on as a sub? I can't. And it's always good to have that sort of weapon in your back pocket of having a player like him that can come in and make such a big impact and can change things around in such a meaningful fashion. So I definitely just keep him as a super sub, if you will. And because they're also, you know, when you're playing as a starter in today's football, it's so important for you to have a player that is defensively responsible, and I don't think Kuda is quite there yet, or at least in the positions that he's being put in, which is as a winger, and just the way that it kind of works right now, you know, those wingers have to be supporting and being defending. So I don't know if Kuda has that defensive acumen right now. You know, he's 19 years old, that he has time, so just bring him up slowly, and it's important to keep in mind where he's at and not seeing with the potential that he can be, that he can have. Moving on, we have another question by Aaron Campbell, which is, do you think Morales' back injury is worse off than the team is letting on?
It kind of makes you wonder. I mean, he doesn't look the same as he did to start the year. Obviously, that first match against New York, I mean, he was sublime. He was brilliant out there. And then he's dropped off quite a bit. And he was pretty quiet again on Saturday afternoon against Houston. I mean, he looked very good again. I mean, we saw some of those ridiculous cross-field pinpoint accurate you know, passes and things like that. He looked really great in that match. And he sort of really dropped off the last 2 weeks or so. So it kind of makes me wonder if it is worse than they're letting on.
It's hard to tell, right? You know, obviously, yeah, we're not privy to, you know, being there day in, day out. One thing is, it's for certain, and is his performances have not been as spectacular as they were in the first 3 or 4 weeks of the season. Maybe we were just spoiled by the first game and the first couple of games that he had. You know, let's remember that he can take a bit of, you know, adjustment. Yeah, so it's hard to tell whether or not it's an actual injury, or the one thing is that he has shown that he can give more and he can provide more on the field. So we can just only hope that if it's an injury, to let him rest and let him, you know, get better, or if it's just a drop in form, to it's just we can attribute it to some adjustment period.
Yeah, I mean, he's still only been in Vancouver for 2 months. So I don't know, in general, not just regarding Pedro, I still think the glass is half full rather than half empty at this point. But I keep looking at the schedule, keep wondering when the easy part is going to come. And I don't think there really are too many easy games in MLS. I don't think that there's too many teams that can be considered a pushover. And I mean, when you kind of look, it's like, oh, great. Well, you know, we LA twice, then we got RSL, and then kind of think, oh, well, you know, then San Jose, they haven't won a game, but San Jose, whenever we play the Earthquakes, is always a pretty tough match. It's always pretty.
They get a scrappy. They're fun.
It gets pretty nasty. And then we've got a Cascadia match coming up, and then Toronto's coming into town for the Voyageurs Cup in a couple of weeks. And then, you know, the first easy match, you know, quote unquote, I saw was against the Montreal Impact, and that's not until June. And I think that the margin in MLS is probably pretty small. I think that any team can beat another team on any given day. Although, you know, the statistics prove that the home team is usually more likely to win. I think it's about 75-25 odds in favor of the home team. But it's not an easy league to win in. But there's definitely things that they need to work on. But one thing I'm surprised about again is that Rio Coker didn't make it onto the pitch 2 weeks in a row after coming back from injury. So I kind of wonder what's going on there. I know sort of hearing here and there that there's been some questions about his fitness level, but yeah, he just did not look like the same player that we saw last year. And I'm just very surprised to see him not even come on as a substitute in the last two games. So,
you know, he's obviously setting a bar, right? And setting a standard. And maybe Nigel is not quite there where Robo want him to be. So it's obviously as supporters, it kind of sucks to see those players who technically should be your better players not making the team. However, at the same time, it's also refreshing seeing that Rob is not going to take anything for granted, right? Or anyone just because, you know, whoever you are or whatever name is on your jersey or what your past is or what you played before, you know, he's willing to, even if he's the $400,000 man, you know, if he's not up to standard and he's not, he doesn't feel that he's going to provide him with the best chance to win a game, he's not going to see the pitch. So on one side, it kind of sucks because, well, you know, it's $400,000 that is, you know, sitting on the bench. But at the same time, if our coach doesn't feel that, you know, he should be playing, it's good to see that he's, you know, making those bold decisions and not playing him. So I guess that for everyone's benefit, you know, obviously for the team, for Nigel himself, and for the supporters, to see our team succeed, hopefully, Nigel, because he, you know, picks up his form and his game and he can start seeing the pitch, because I think that he's a key player and that will, help, this team have success.
So, okay, well, just looking ahead really briefly then to RSL this week, I still think that they still have to work on the same things that we are, the same keys that we are looking to for this week, for this past week against LA. You know, they have to pressure the ball a little bit more. They have to keep the shape in the formation. They have to be, you know, take their chances a little bit more. And we just need to see that link up play in the middle of the park a little bit better. The forwards need service. I, you know, heard the comment over the weekend that the Whitecaps don't win if Kenny Miller doesn't score. And, you know, that seems to be the case, at least in the, you know, this early part of the season so far. So it's important that the forwards do get the service. I mean, obviously we know that the Whitecaps also don't have a great record against Real Salt Lake. Of course, one draw, two losses, the 2-2 draw here at BC Place last year. Then, you know, we lost down there, and then obviously that infamous, which I think was really the game that ended our playoff hopes when Real came up here. I guess it was the end of September, beginning of October, when they basically fielded their reserve side and, you know, beat the Whitecaps on that day. So they're not a team that really have a lot of flashy stars, but they're always seem to have players that are very effective. They always seem to find people that can play the roles that they need. So it'll be another challenge for Vancouver to go down there and get any points. So it'll be interesting to see how they perform once again on the road, because it's not really a long road trip to go down to it. It'll be interesting to see what they can do.
Well, I think that there's going to be two keys. Number one is going to be to if any supporters are going to be making the trip down to Utah, if they can slash Nick Romando's tires or maybe hide his gloves, so he doesn't see the pitch, because Romando seems to have amazing games against the Whitecaps every time.
Well, he's in general a very good goalie.
So maybe we can keep him off the pitch. Maybe that will help a little bit. And I think that we should also try and shave Kyle Beckerman's head, because I think that's the key of his success in the pitch. It's like
his Samson. Magic powers are contained within his dreadlocks.
Yes. So I think that if we can accomplish that before the game, I think the Whitecaps are going to have a really good chance.
Okay, wait, let me get a notepad here. Okay. Number one, lock Romando in bathroom, and two, shave Kyle Beckerman's head.
That's it. That's all we need.
Keys to the game. You heard it here first.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't know. I'm still thinking that it'll be tough for them to go down there and get a draw. But if they play, they stick to their game, and if they can figure out some of that, what's going on in the midfield, then who knows, right?
Yeah, and I think that's the key. I think that if as long as they maintain that focus and their shape, they should be able to do well. I think Darren Maddock plays well down in Utah, so maybe we can. This won't finally be the game that cements his uprising form.
All right, then. So I'm going to put you on the spot. Prediction?
I think it's going to be a 2-1 Salt Lake.
I'm going to go for a 1-1 draw. I think that we can get at least a point on the road. So we'll see.
You've been pretty good in the last two. I think that you have had the last two predictions correct. Maybe not the scores, but at least the actual draw or loss.
I actually predicted the starting 11, actually everybody in the position that they were assigned to on the pitch and the formation on Saturday. So, I'm...
Can we start calling you the Oracle? Mark the Oracle daily?
But sir, just kind of getting off on a tangent, there is a bit of a scandal brewing over in England. It was all over the BBC Football and also on the Radio 5 Live football podcast about some shady dealings going on between Crystal Palace and I think it was Cardiff City, about how Crystal Palace managed to get their starting lineup a day or so before the match and exploit the matchups that they wanted to. And, they won that match. I think it was like a 3-0 or 3-1 or something like that. But, I didn't have to, use any connections, and you'll find out the formation, the starting 11 before the match. I just used my crystal ball and my tea leaf reading and, magic sticks or something.
Goat blood.
Yeah, actually, I just kind of think, last time they played at home, he went for the 4-4-2 diamond. So how did he do that the last time? So
you're giving out the secrets.
There's no real secrets here, man. Everybody knows that already. But anyways, that's pretty much all the time we have for this week. Thanks again for all of you for listening. If you want to get in touch with us, you can send us an email.
Before we go, I do have a couple things. Number one, I want to give a shout out to our left back, Jordan Harvey, because he recently finished his degree out of UCLA.
Oh, congratulations to Jordan.
Education is paramount, and I think that is great that obviously he had to put maybe that on hold for a little bit because of his professional career as a soccer player, but it's great to see that he went back and finished, and it's a great accomplishment, and so good, kudos to him.
Yeah, that's awesome news. Good for Jordan. Yeah, so, and then, of course, obviously, the other big news in football today, David Moyes was sacked as manager of Manchester United. Of course, they said they'd agreed mutually to part ways, which is, I think, a way to politically sort of mask things and say that, you got fired, but we're saving face. We're going to say that we both agreed to mutually part company. So,
well, I cannot confirm nor deny that I have been approached about that. So let's just keep it at that.
Okay, well, when you get hired, are you at least going to give me tickets or a t-shirt or something?
Well, you're going to be there, so...
All right, well, like I say, we're pretty much out of time for this week, and if any of you want to get in touch with us, like Aaron did, send us an email from thebackline@outlook.com or tweet us at @FromTheBackline. That's it for us. We'll catch you all again next week.
Have a great week.